Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful and steamy Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure to join you today. We're going to have a terrific show. Our guest today is going to be a cultural historian and social critic, Morris Berman, author of the brand new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. I think this is going to be a really interesting show. Berman makes a compelling argument about the state of our society today and the role of the media in it. I think you'll have a great time listening to Morris Berman. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Nearly a month passed between the Federal Communications Commission voting to reconsider its media ownership rules in the direction of allowing more consolidation and the agency actually releasing a proposal to move forward with the project. The proposal is pretty slim, taking up less than 30 pages to discuss revisions to ownership rules involving newspapers, cable systems, and radio and TV stations and networks, and the limits on how much of each one company may own. The public has just 120 days in which to comment on the FCC's proposal, although already more than 30,000 people have done so. Some of them sit on the FCC's Consumer Advisory Committee, which met in July and strongly recommended that the agency keep localism, viewpoint diversity, and democratic access to media central to any reforms it may undertake. Visit stopbigmedia.com to learn more about the new rulemaking and how you can make your thoughts on the subject known to the FCC.
A federal judge in California has denied the government's attempt to kill a lawsuit that accuses AT&T of illegally colluding with the National Security Agency on their surveillance of domestic phone and internet traffic. The case was filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other plaintiffs after it came to light that AT&T may have offered the government unfettered access to its voice and data traffic without court approval or oversight. The Justice Department tried to have the entire case thrown out on grounds that it might expose state secrets, but attorney Robert Fram, who's working closely with the EFF on the case, says the judge knew better.
He refused to dismiss the case at the outset, where that would sacrifice liberty for no apparent enhancement of security.
EFF staff attorney Kevin Bankston says the judge also correctly recognized that the case is not directly about who the government may or may not be spying on.
The true violation here is AT&T's. Whether or not AT&T gave the government access to communications and records in the first place.
This opens up the way for the Electronic Frontier Foundation to begin probing AT&T for evidence to back up its claims. That process could begin as early as August. While this case is a complicated one, EFF legal director Cindy Cohen says they're not alone in court.
There are approximately 35 cases nationally arising out of the illegal wiretapping and stored records issues.
For example, when New Jersey's Attorney General served subpoenas to AT&T, Verizon, Quest, Sprint, Nextel, and Singular Wireless in May, asking for information on whether or not they violated consumer privacy by turning over call records for surveillance purposes, the U.S. Department of Justice sued New Jersey, claiming that state officials have no business sticking their noses into matters of national security. The feds have also intervened in a similar suit filed in Missouri. Both of these cases are still pending. However, the state secrets argument did recently convince a judge in Chicago to toss a lawsuit filed against AT&T over its alleged involvement in the government's data mining. A bill being debated in the Senate, which would put all government surveillance under the supervision of a special court, threatens to derail all of these cases. The EFF claims this proposal would effectively rubber stamp current and future spying programs by making court oversight of them completely voluntary, not mandatory, as required by current law.
And government propagandists are finding creative new ways to pound home their talking points. Earlier this spring, United Airlines was paid $36,000 to show a 13-minute military recruiting advertisement on its in-flight video systems targeted at parents of military-aged children. A longer version of the program is offered to U.S. television stations for free. Several stations have aired it. Disclosure of the Defense Department's role in the program is not given until the very end of the credits. In addition, senior officials at cabinet-level executive branch agencies received a directive to slip in talking points about the U.S. occupation of Iraq into every public speech they give. An email announcing the program even included helpful examples of how officials at agencies seemingly unconnected to Iraq, like the Department of Agriculture, could slip positive references into their talks. In Iraq itself, a U.S. PR company that caused controversy by planting good news stories ghostwritten by the U.S. military in supposedly independent Iraqi newspapers is now off the job. The Pentagon pulled the Lincoln Group and one other private spin shop out of that particular psychological operation after harsh criticism that it undermined Iraq's fledgling free press. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters, July 30, 2006. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from WILL AM 580 in beautiful and steamy Urbana, Illinois today. Today we have a terrific show for you, a show I've been looking forward to for a long time. One of my favorite authors, someone I've had a chance to read several of his books now, and the author of a brand new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. Our guest today, Morris Berman, has taught at a number of universities in Europe and North America and held visiting endowed chairs at several universities as well. He's written a trilogy on human consciousness, the reenchantment of the world, coming to our senses, and Wandering God, a study in nomadic spirituality. And the book I have most familiar with prior to his new one, his 2000 book, Twilight of American Culture, which was named a notable book by the New York Times Book Review. As I said, his brand new book is Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. It's jumping up the bestseller list, and it's an honor to welcome him to our show today. Morris Berman, you there?
I am, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you, Mr. Berman, and I've just finished your book on my vacation. I took it along with me, and it was troubling as all your recent work's been, but entertaining. Somehow you're entertaining me as you're telling me the end of the world is rapidly approaching.
One has to have a sense of humor about these things.
Yeah, I think you do. And let's talk about the title, first of all, because the title, and I wish people would see the graphic, which is the flame and the Statue of Liberty snuffed out. The title, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. What are you saying in that title?
Well, you know, Bob, when I the previous book that you mentioned, Twilight of American Culture, the goal of that was to, or what I came up with, was a comparison on an internal basis between the United States, contemporary America, and Rome in the late empire period, from an internal structural point of view. And, you know, basically I said there were a number of factors that were in common with these two civilizations had in common, and that if we didn't deal with those factors in our own civilization, we would go the way of the Roman Empire. So that was where I was at. And the working title of the sequel, which, frankly, after I finished Twilight, I didn't intend to write, but 9/11 changed all of that. And the working title of the sequel was called Colossus Adrift. And as I began to work on it, it became clearer and clearer that it wasn't merely that we were a colossus that was adrift, didn't know where we were going, and so on, but it was much stronger than that. We were beyond the phase of the late Roman Empire, and we had entered into a kind of medievalization of our own culture, the early Middle Ages or the Dark Ages. And so that was the comparison I sought to make in this book, and the introduction lays out the factors that I think, in this case, are similar now, not to the late Roman Empire, but actually to the early Middle Ages.
You know, but let's talk a little bit about the late Roman Empire and bring it forward, because I suspect many of our listeners know very little about the late Roman Empire other than the fact that it existed since there was a Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about the late Roman Empire that you saw similarities with to our current situation or to our recent situation in the United States, and then talk about the, you know, Dark Ages.
Sure. If I can remember back to the Twilight book, there were four features that I thought were similar. One was the growing gap between rich and poor. You had a situation in the late Roman Empire where it was a handful of families that owned all of the land between the Rhine and the Euphrates, thousands of square miles in the hands of very, very few people. And such a political formation really was not able to sustain itself. And by the time I was writing the Twilight book, actually a few years before, the statistics were that 1% of the American population owned 49% of the wealth. So it was comparable to a Roman situation, and also I felt rather unstable. A second feature of comparison was the dwindling levels of literacy and general intellectual awareness in the two cases. By the late Roman Empire, now that we look over the Latin text, for example, and you read the writings of some of the leading intellectuals of the late Roman Empire, their syntax is bad and their spelling is off. I mean, these are the leading intellectual figures of the late Roman Empire, and they didn't know how to write anymore. The days of Cicero were long gone. And it seemed to me something was happening like that in the United States. As, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I never remembered seeing spelling errors on the front page of the New York Times. Now I see them all the time. And one can say that's a small thing, but I think it's an indicator of a kind of carelessness and even an inability to use language correctly, to think straight. And then there's the general, you know, stats that I gathered about. They were quite unbelievable about American ignorance and so on. And then a third factor was that the Roman Empire, late Roman Empire, lost the ability to pay its bills, basically. In other words, basic bureaucratic functioning had hit a point of diminishing returns. This is something that happens, actually, to every empire that breaks up. And Joseph Tainter talks about it in his book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, that there's a kind of plateau period where in order to collect, let's say, a certain amount of dollars or denarius and taxes, you have to pay the tax collector the same amount that they're collecting. And so you're just spinning wheels. You've reached a point of diminishing returns. And basically what I said in the Twilight book was that we weren't going to be able to pay for Medicare and Social Security. They were getting too enormous, and we were running out of the money for them. And then finally, the last factor I talked about was a kind of spiritual death in the sense of an acknowledged apathy within these respective civilizations, that it was understood on some sort of visceral and gut level that the civilization had played out and there was very little meaning left in people's lives. Just recently, actually, the folks at C-SPAN alerted me to a poll that was done by the Wall Street Journal asking people about the state of America, and something like 60% said that they felt that America was in trouble, that it was on the wrong track and it was in bad shape. And in the subsequent poll, 81% of those said that the United States was actually in long-term decline. This is the first time I had ever seen, I mean, I would take the Wall Street Journal as a reliable source, as a polling device, and this was the first time I had ever seen something like that, that you could say that perhaps a vast majority from this poll of the American people feel that the country's going nowhere, that it has no real future, and it's a state of long-term decline. That would be an example of a spiritual death or an apathy that pervades the country. So those are the factors that I was talking about at that time as far as the late Roman Empire went.
Our guest today, Morris Berman, author of the new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, just been published this summer by Norton, climbing up the bestseller list, and a book well worth reading. I read it on my summer vacation. And Morris Berman, as you know, I'm assigning it in my class this fall. So,
well, I'll be very interested in how the students react, actually.
I will be, too. Believe me, I'm going to have things to be very interesting. One of the things that was different about this book, and I think of a special importance compared to your the last book you wrote, The Twilight of American Culture, is that the military aspect of the argument of the final phase of empire is a military empire, is a geopolitical empire, plays a larger role in this book.
Yeah.
And in the introduction, you talk about some of the signs of the final phase of an empire in the military sense, what goes on. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Now, that was something that I didn't really talk about in the Twilight book because, you know, these things are always interested, you know, obvious in hindsight, as they say. And I had not intended to write a sequel to the Twilight book, but after 9/11, it was clear to me that if I were going to make a comparison between the United States and the Roman Empire, the most obvious factor had been omitted, and that was that Rome had been invaded. It was attacked from the outside by people they called barbarians. It was then drawn into a war of attrition. After all, militarily, Rome was everywhere, and that was the classic case of imperial overstretch, where they couldn't maintain an army throughout the entire Mediterranean basin, and that we had attempted to do something similar with our military bases everywhere, and that, of course, now we had been attacked for the first time on our own soil since roughly 1812, I think, by the British, and that didn't really count. They sort of singed the White House a little bit. This was a lot more serious, and we didn't understand, or claim not to understand, at least on the official level, the motivations of these people beyond the fact that they were, quote, insane and deranged and hostile to our freedom, and all of which does not provide any analysis of why it occurred. And we were then going to do all of the wrong things because we either didn't understand or pretended that we didn't understand what was going on. And that was the war of attrition that finally I didn't believe we're going to win over the long range. We were going to lose this, and this was going to be something that was going to undo us. So I spent a lot of time on, if you want to understand who these folks are and why they would choose to attack the World Trade Center and so on, you'd better understand a lot about the history of U.S. foreign policy, especially as it affects the Middle East and the role of the military in that, because otherwise you have no chance, really, of addressing what the problem is, since the premises on which you're operating are totally fabricated.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Morris Berman, author of the new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. This is a live show coming to you July 30th, 2006, here in Campbell Hall, studios of WILL AM 580, beautiful Urbana, Illinois. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment for Morris Berman, the number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455, and our lines are open. Morris Berman, in reading this book, and one thing that you've already talked about and the parallel to the decline of the Roman Empire in the Dark Ages is the decline of rationalism, of critical thinking in the general population and in the intellectual class, both. And a general sort of inability of people to deal with the crisis they find themselves in to solve it. What role does the U.S. media and the U.S. educational system play in aggravating the situation, in your view?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Bob. And, you know, I have to say in general terms, I think there's a phenomenon that every culture has of blocking negative feedback. Feedback that actually could help it if it dealt with it, but there is a tendency that I think we all have as individuals and that societies have of seeing to it that information that we don't like to hear doesn't come through. In some cases, it wouldn't really matter. I mean, for example, suppose we were in Switzerland, how crucial would that be? And suppose I were a Swiss biochemist and I had written a book called Chocolate, the Silent Killer. I have a feeling I wouldn't be making it on a lot of talk shows in Zurich, just the suspicion, you know. But the thing is that in the case, you know, Switzerland is not that crucial, one might argue, for the future of the world. But in the case of the United States, not making sure that you never listen to your critics is a good way of committing cultural suicide. And, of course, this was one of the arguments of Arnold Toynbee that civilizations really, it's not that they were invaded and wiped out as much as that they died by their own hand. They sort of wiped themselves out. One of the ways of doing that is making sure that the critical information that could help you address what your problems are never get a hearing. And in that sense, I have felt, especially with the media, that our form of censorship here is a whole lot more sophisticated, let's say, than that of the former Soviet Union, where simply, you know, information couldn't get in, you couldn't buy books and so on. But it's a lot more subtle, smooth, and ultimately effective, because the information finally doesn't reach people to make a reassessment. And so just to take a single example, it's very difficult. You can do it, but it's very difficult to find the full statements of the texts of Osama bin Laden's addresses to the American people. What you have in the American press is maybe a couple of statements from his recent, whatever it will be, recent address, and then spin. Well, what he really means is this. I mean, some of the papers never say, you know, he means what he says. Let's think about that. No, no, no. What he really means, and then there's a whole ton of spin based on two sentences. Well, you know, you can go to English.aljazeera.org, I think it is, and print out the full text of those speeches. And when I read them, you know, they're eminently sensible. It's not that I'm, you know, condoning the slaughter of innocents or saying that 9/11, you know, was right in any sense of the word or anything like that. But what he says in his talks is, you know, there's been a long history of the West, and America in particular, supporting those forces that hurt Islam and hurt Muslims. And let me give you a detailed list. And then he does. And then he says, basically, I have said over and over again, interviews at CNN and Time Magazine in the 90s, if you screw with us, we'll screw with you. And I made good on that promise. Now, if you want to get out of that spiral, what you need to do is to think about the causes of what we're doing, because we're not doing this. We didn't, you know, if the whole idea is that we are opposed to liberty, well, you know, we didn't blow up any buildings in Sweden. I mean, this man talks in a very, very intelligent way. And when you read those documents, you say, well, he's giving us the way out. Stop hurting us, we'll stop hurting you. But somehow the American people do not get that information. You have to dig to get it. The American newspapers don't provide the full text. And so it's easy to create an impression of evil madmen doing these things. And that's a recipe for not, you know, for escalating the conflict and not really getting out of the situation we're in. So that's just one example of the type of thing that gets blocked in the press, so that Americans can't inform themselves about it and maybe come to different conclusions than the administration would have them come to.
And Morris Berman, in your book, Dark Ages America, you have long discussions precisely of Middle East politics and U.S. role there historically, to amplify the point you just made about understanding the cause of the current conflict in the Middle East and the role of the U.S. and the unpopularity of the United States in the region. Our guest today on Media Matters is Morris Berman, author of the new book, Dark Ages America. Phone number here at Media Matters, WILL AM 580, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Morris Berman.
Yes. I have read a number of his books, The Twilight of American Culture and the current one, Dark Ages America. And my question is Mr. Berman planning to do any tours or come through any communities close to Champaign-Urbana with the book? I would definitely appreciate an opportunity to hear him speak. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks so much. A couple of things. One is that I did do in April, May, my publisher, Norton, sent me on a book tour to various cities. And somehow Chicago got omitted, and I apologize for that. The paperback will be out, I'm guessing, next March, because it's a year cycle, and it's possible that Norton will send me on such a trip. The other thing is that I typically say yes when I'm invited by institutions, so that can always happen. But the thing that I wanted to mention right now that our caller and listeners in general might be interested in, and that is that on that book tour that I mentioned, May 19th, I was in New Dominion Bookshop in Charlottesville, Virginia, and that was a very exciting evening. It lasted about 75 minutes, and it practically turned into a town meeting with people having very strong emotions about what they were worried about, and it was a very good evening. And C-SPAN taped it, and they ran it the first time, I think it was July 22nd, and they ran it the second time at 4 o'clock this morning. I don't think too many people were up. I said this is the vampire crowd, apparently. But it was at 4 o'clock this morning on C-SPAN, and I'm guessing that they'll run it again. And you can go to booktv.org for their schedule of all their programs and find out. I don't know myself when there will be next run, but I'm guessing there will. And so you can see it, you know, on television if you have cable, because it's C-SPAN 2, and the next, you know, program will be there. And it's also the case that I haven't tried it myself, but sooner or later I think they archive. BookTV.org archives these things, and so you could play it on your computer based on a link. You know, so if I don't actually make it out to Illinois in the flesh, you might be able to pick up some videos.
Morris Berman, in your book and in your earlier book, I mean, a lot of the talk is about the failure of the intellectual class to also do its role of in society, of sort of being an early warning system and clarifying issues and leading and guiding debate and understanding of issues. What's your sense of the intelligentsia in the United States today, the state of higher education and research? I mean, we have an enormous higher education apparatus in this country, probably more PhDs than all the other societies in the world combined.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we in this crisis if we have so much intellectual firepower?
I think the most important thing that has hurt us, I mean, there are a lot of factors we could name, the fad over deconstruction and postmodernism. You know, the careerism that's inherent in the academic world, it's imitation of the corporate world, it's direct links to the corporate world. I mean, there are a lot of things like that. But to me, the overwhelming thing is that above all, the United States is a consumerist commodity culture. And nothing is exempt from that, including opposition to it. And what has happened is that there has been a collusion on the part of the academics in the United States, the faculty, with the administrations of universities. This even in the case of very, very good universities, that we are, as academics, supplying a commodity, that the students sitting in front of us are clients or customers. And once you move from a medieval model, and I say this in a positive sense, of master-apprentice, I studied something for many years, it's my delight to teach it to you, here's how it's going to go, this is what we're going to study, this is what you need to do, this is how to think, and so on and so forth. Once you move from that kind of model to a model of a service industry where the only thing that counts is that the customer be satisfied and that my continuation as a faculty member is going to depend on student evaluations that the dean and the administration have a very keen interest in because that's where the cash flow is, you're doomed as an institution. The teachers that taught me the most, when I look back, are the ones that produce what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. They challenged my worldview. They made me uncomfortable. Maybe I even hated them. But they got me to think. And if their jobs had depended on my evaluation of their teaching at the time, they would have been fired. If I had written the evaluation 10 years later, it would have been quite glowing. But frankly, I didn't know anything at age 20. And the situation in which the faculty is held hostage to students and the deans are colluding in this so that it's only a question of cash flow, the similarity to selling indulgences on the part of the Catholic Church in the High Middle Ages is a little too obvious, you know, to mention, but I mention it. And that means that basically anybody can get a degree, anybody can get through. We've got to be very, very careful in tiptoeing around the feelings and self-esteem and all that sort of thing of the students. Make sure they're happy. Well, the professors that counted in my life were not interested in popularity and were not out to make sure I was happy. They were out to challenge me. And working against the grain, that's how I learned something. And once that goes, nothing really is that much as getting learned or taught within an academic system. In fact, I would say that what's left now in the United States is probably about 100 small liberal arts colleges that really, really teach reality. I mean, are really doing a job of, you know, the students learning something and not pleasing, playing those kinds of client-customer games. Very, very small handful. The rest are playing a large consumer commercial game. Well, once you turn education into a commodity, it's no longer education. It's entertainment.
Our guest today, Morris Berman, author of the new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, just published by Norton Books, available at bookstores and online. If you'd like to talk to Morris Berman on Media Matters today, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Morris Berman.
Hi, yeah. I don't really know where to begin. I haven't really disagreed with anything he said. I guess I'd start by mentioning the first thing you were just talking about. I've just come from California, where I taught for a year at a private school, where really it is a customer-based situation, and the school is set up toward customer satisfaction. It has education is really going to the wayside at this school, and teaching these kids any real life situations. I mean, that anyway. I'm digressing. I started calling because I was interested. You talked about how there's subtle propaganda or subtle control of the media, and I wonder how we get around that when there's such an interconnectedness between corporations, the government, and the media. At what point do we start creating divisions to keep these separate?
Thank you very much, caller. Morris Berman?
Yeah, it's a very important question because really down to about, mid-60s, in a certain sense, the academic establishment was the royal opposition. I mean, it could be counted on. Its critical faculty, its function as critique could be counted on to say that all of life is not about business. All of life is not about profit. There are other values, and that's what we're about. It lasted down to about something like that. And how to reestablish those barriers, I think, is going to be very difficult, because right now what I notice is I'll get calls like that from, you know, a caller just spoke, or I'll get emails from faculty members that clearly within their own situations are doing their best to reestablish those kinds of boundaries between the two, so that isn't this osmotic leak and everything turns into American corporate consumer culture. But it's being done, my point is that it's being done on an individual basis rather than as a large-scale movement. And it's very hard within the context of the United States to reestablish it, because there's always this charge of elitism that Americans in particular are afraid of being charged with. When I get called an elitist in radio programs and that sort of thing, I say thank you. I'm honored by that label, because you can't have a civilization without a hierarchy of quality. That's what elitism is. It means that some ideas and some ways of life are better than others. If I wanted to study tennis, for example, I'm a tennis player, if I wanted to study and I hired Pete Sampras, for example, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for me to go out in the court and say, you know, Pete, we're co-learners. Let's not be elitist here. You and I are co-learners. So maybe you can pick up a few pointers from me, too. I mean, the ridiculousness of that is quite obvious, and yet academics let themselves be drawn into this type of thing where students are making academic decisions. And so to reclaim that and stop the consumer model, I think, is a tough fight. I don't have an easy recipe, but I know that individuals are trying to do it and sometimes just write about the whole thing. Usually they write about it using a pseudonym. There was a Peter Sachs, not his real name, for example, who wrote a book called Generation X Goes to College, in which he told the story of how he got tenure by turning his class into a kindergarten session. And then they wrote fabulous, the students wrote fabulous reviews and thought he was the greatest teacher in the world and so on. Recently there was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education about a woman who used a nom de plume, a phony name, and talked about how she needed tenure. And so basically she started giving out all A's, and guess what? It worked. I think there are, right now there's not an official movement that I know of to say elitism is good, let's get it back in education.
Well, Morris, if I can interrupt, Morris Berman, in your book, going to the more broad question of just, reversing the path this country is on, the final phase of empire, reversing, getting out of the dark ages, returning to a more humane civilization and a dynamic and vibrant society. You're very pessimistic about, it's not even implied. You come flat out and say it can't happen. There's not the ability in the society to turn it around. It's over.
Yeah, I really do believe that. I don't believe there's any exit, and I think things will get worse over time. The thing is that in the twilight of American culture, what I do have is a chapter called something like the new monastic option.
Yeah, the book people. I remember that.
Right, yeah. And what I say is that individuals, it's not a solution. This is just sociology 101. In order to, if a society has structural problems, then it's going to take structural solutions. And if you start looking at individual initiative, you've already, in a sense, given up on the society. But what I talk about is that individuals can by themselves, doing acts of cultural preservation, perhaps contribute to a different future, and that it's worth doing. And that's what I would encourage anybody that sends me an email along these lines, and I say, do what you can to restore elitism to education. Education isn't a democratic process. We're not voting on grades here or on truth. Some people know and some people don't know, and that's why you go to college, and don't give me any BS about it. So it's sort of like, right now I think it has to be done on an individual sort of basis, but in the long run, I think we will erode along precisely these lines. Everything will be melted down in a kind of undifferentiated mush. And so I don't have an optimistic view overall about our civilization. I just don't think it's going to last. But I would still advocate that monastic model of individual attempts because it's not only worth it for yourself, but you can pull a few fish out of the drink. You can touch a number of students. In a classroom of 100, maybe you can touch two who get it that you're not supposed to be popular and entertain them, and who will respect that and pass it on to somebody else. And that may be, at this crucial juncture in our history, the best any college professor can do.
Our guest today, Morris Berman, author of the new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. We have many callers, very patient, waiting to talk with Dr. Berman. So let's go to the phone lines now. Fryna, Illinois, hotbed of Media Matters listeners. You're on the air with Morris Berman.
Hi. Why shouldn't I just take a gun and shoot myself? American culture, the thing I believed in when I was growing up, and, the Constitution and everything else, and what's to keep the so-called survivalist movement, the extremist anti-militants from gaining a real foothold? And, it harks back to the foothold that Hitler, he talked about how the Germans were betrayed and that back to the land, I think this is a fascinating topic, and I just wonder what's a future? What is a future for America?
Yeah, what is the shape of the Dark Ages? What's
right? Let's talk about that. The first thing is that offhand, having studied a number of civilizations and books about histories of civilizations, I have to say that there are only two examples I can think of where the crash was almost sudden. That was the Mayan Empire. We still don't know why it fell apart, but it fell apart almost overnight. And the second was the Soviet Union, which fell apart in 2 years, at least on the visible level. I think it was falling apart for 73 years. But on the visible level, it fell apart in 2 years. That will not be the American pattern. That will not be the American pattern. The pattern will be much more like Rome, or, if you will, the British Empire, which is a kind of uneven but nevertheless steady erosion of values, quality, and significant influence. So from that point of view, it's a slow slide into the Dark Ages, and one day is like any other. But if you look back, let's say over a 20-year period, you're suddenly aware that this is a different country now, at least I am, than it was 20 years ago, and it'll be a very different country 20 years from now.
And if I can interrupt, Morris Berman, because I don't want to talk purely in large structural terms about statistics, damn place. I mean, in your book, you go on in great detail about the actual fabric of social life, the quality of how people interact and deal with each other,
right,
and the regard humans hold each other. I mean, this is what you're talking about as you talk about the collapse of a civilization, aren't you?
Right, right. And you know, there are a lot of good, political scientists or sociologists. I'm thinking of somebody like Richard Sennett in particular, who really does describe the grain and the quality of life. And I try to do that in my books, to say, don't you feel this happening? Because that really is an important thing, that it's a very different country now than it was 15 or 20 years ago on the sensible level, on the felt level. You know, I live in a large apartment building in Washington, D.C., and I can tell you that it's only a slight exaggeration that if I were to die in the lobby, the rest of the residents would be annoyed that there was a corpse blocking their way to the mailboxes. That's how much little we care about each other in this country. That's become the norm now. It's different in different parts of the country, of course, and different cities are different. But by and large, one of the felt aspects that we're talking about here of a civilization collapse is that there is no safety net, and there really is no sense of immediate compassion or responsibility for other people. It's just, every person for themselves, kind of thing. And that's the felt dimension, I think, of a society that's coming apart at the seams. I think we're going to see a lot more of that type of thing. Katrina was an X-ray of the American psyche. All those pictures were like dream pictures. They were like X-rays of the American psyche. But that's the reality of our psyche. Sink or swim by yourself. Who cares about you? And that's a tragic place to get to, but I think there's going to be a lot more of that as time goes on.
Well, a lot of commentators today and guests on this show have talked about the communication revolution, the internet, and the community that is creating online between people who physically are separate and maybe living in suburban houses and driving cars, but now suddenly can link together. And the power that gives people politically to arrest the forces you're talking about. Are you enthusiastic about new technologies and the internet?
I really don't have any faith in it at all, because I think that reality between human beings happens through body language, and that without the force of personality and the immediacy of presence, all that thing doesn't really matter.
Well, what if you have video cameras so you can see each other over the internet?
That might help. I mean that might actually help, but there's something about the mediation of that technology that creates an abstraction. I don't believe that these things are communities any more than when Walmart talks about, you know, the family of Walmart, some family, you know. So I'm skeptical about things like MoveOn.org and so on really being able to make a difference. Maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe I'll be surprised. But that doesn't strike me as community. It remains the case that we are bodies. And, it's that line about the Stone Age baby is born into the 21st century. It's still a Stone Age baby, and it still needs its mother's milk, and it laughs when it's tickled, and it has an immediate cognizance of the atmosphere around it. We still are biological entities, and that's how community is formed. And I don't think that it can be strung together in any meaningful, enduring sense in a virtual way. That's just my own opinion.
Morris Berman, our guest today, author of the brand new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, just released this year by Norton Books. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Morris Berman.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Fine.
Good. Just a few comments and one definite question. I saw you last Sunday and saw parts of it, loved it, and as part of the vampire crowd, I saw you again last night. It's great. But you mentioned Osama bin Laden and reading his entire statements and so forth. I haven't done that, but my impression is that his position and that of a bunch of together radical Islam, that there, that it's incompatible with the West, that the goal is the destruction of the Western way of life, and that there's no real meeting ground. Can you address that? Maybe you're misinformed or uninformed about that. And point two, in your book, which was recalled by the library, it seems to be very popular, you talk about Europe's safety, massive safety, social safety net, and could you comment a tiny bit about that? And then I'll make one comment, if I may, that I tend to think you're right about the United States being in a long, slow twilight. And myself, I just see unrestrained capitalism running rampant around the globe and eventually causing some sort of economic disaster. But I'll hang up and listen, and I love your book. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Morris Berman, take it away.
Well, a lot of good questions. There is a section that I have in Dark Ages America discussing whether or not Islam and its very nature is incompatible with Western democracy and our values and so on. This is the Samuel Huntington clash of civilizations notion, that there's an essentialist difference between the two. And frankly, there are some differences that I think are essentialist. It's just that when you read the objections, for example, that bin Laden has to what the West has done to it, in America in particular, he's not appealing to those things. Occasionally there's things like that, but his list of grievances are things like U.S. troops on Saudi soil and support for Israel exclusively at the expense of the Palestinians. In other words, the list of grievances doesn't go back to Saladin in the Middle Ages or anything like that. It's, by and large, what we as an empire have done to the Islamic world since 1945. That's where his focus is. And when he concludes, and he says in the most recent address to the Americans, I don't have it right here in front of me, but there was a line toward the end, he says, some of you, some Americans will recognize that the path to peace deals with treating other people fairly, you know. So when I see stuff like that, I tend to think that the essentialist elements that he may occasionally refer to and that Samuel Huntington emphasizes tremendously are overblown. I just have the impression that since their emphasis is on what we did since World War II, if we stopped doing those things, they wouldn't care what we did and what kind of culture that we were. In fact, Arab youth, you know, get a big kick out of email and Mickey Mouse and jeans and stuff like that. They may hate our politics, but they love our culture. And so, during the Cold War, it was the same thing that we really, the propaganda was that the Soviet Union wanted to take over the world. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart and the KGB archives were opened in 1991, and American and Russian historians began to look at what was there, that wasn't it at all. I mean, that was just hot air. This was a risk-averse civilization that did not want to challenge the United States and, in fact, was more nervous about Germany than it was about the United States. And all that talk about world revolution largely served internal Soviet purposes about shoring up its own institutions. I think something similar is going on here. I mean, for Americans to be sitting around worrying that all their women are going to be wearing burqas because waves of Mongol hordes are going to sweep through the United States. Finally, I remember Alan Arkin, I think it was, did a film in the 80s called The Russians Are Coming, which parodied this American fear that the Russians were going to land at Gloucester and move west. And take, you know, it's not like that. That's not the intent. What these people want to be doing is largely left alone. Not take over the world with Islam, I think, regardless of the rhetoric. And I think we're a little too worried about that. And when bin Laden ends his speech saying, if you want peace, don't make war on other people, what he's saying is we really want to be left alone.
We got a full bank of phone calls. We've only got about 8 or 9 minutes left, so I'm going to try to get everyone in now. Callers, when I get to you, please try to be as brief as possible. Thank you very much. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Morris Berman.
Yeah, thank you. Call me crazy, but as sad and uncomfortable as maybe for us in the United States, I kind of view our decline as an empire as probably a very positive thing for the world as a whole. And I've long come to the view that the primary function of the Bush-Cheney regime is really to accelerate this decline, as unwitting as it might be on their part. They're really accelerating this decline, which has been going on for some time, and I just would like to know your analysis of that. Thanks.
Yeah, this is a very good point. After all, if we're going to, a friend of mine, I remember discussing this with him, and he said, what's bad about the decline of the United States? We're doing a lot of damage. Let it decline. You know, so, I mean, one could argue that, especially what we're doing to the environment, just, you know, for starters. I mean, one could argue that. At the same time, there's a lot I admire about U.S. history and the nature of political freedom and democracy and so on. I would hate to see that go the way of all flesh. But at the end of the book, I basically say there are two possibilities here. One is a rapid decline, and one is a gradual decline. No decline is not an option, but one of those two are possible. And I agree with you that the function of, you know, historically of the Bush-Cheney kind of configuration is rapid decline. By electing Democrats, and I really don't see there are any other choices. We're not going to elect Dennis Kucinich. By electing Democrats, what we can do is slow the decline a little bit. But, you know, it's sort of like the difference between empire and empire light. So, you know, I would largely agree with you that it may be that the function of highly self-destructive sorts of individuals and governments, such as represented by the Bush administration, are serving a certain historical purpose. It's just that I'm aware that, you know, historically the United States has had a lot of greatness to it and a lot of quality as well that goes down the drain with everything else. But in terms of the preservation of American culture, we are way past the days when American culture was Emily Dickinson and Miles Davis. I mean, it's now just Burger King and, you know, associated stuff like that. And so what?
Morris, as I was reading your book, Morris Berman, I mean, and you're making the argument about the United States and its decline, a side of me couldn't help saying, aren't you really making an argument about our species? Because really, the factors you're talking about in the United States are globalizing fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason to think that a hegemonic China or India or some other country will not emulate us fairly quickly if they can ever achieve that sort of hegemonic position?
Yeah, China is already. As a matter of fact, my take on China is that it's the United States in Mandarin. You know, it's not doing, it's a large commercial empire that is polluting even worse than we are and so on and so forth. So that would not, if it rises to power as a substitute as we decline, I don't see that as a particular improvement. It's a question of what replaces the United States, what its values are going to be, and if they're just going to be copies of an anti-environmental, anti-safety net, anti and so on, then what would be the achievement? So I think you raise a very important point that the larger model is this, you know, industrial world that I think is something that goes beyond any civilization, although we seem to be the spearhead of it right now.
We've got three callers. I'm going to get to each of you, so can I ask each to be as quick as possible? Line 4, Edgar County, you're on the air with Morris Berman.
Good afternoon. 40 years ago, I experienced this situation when I was at a major Illinois university in my master's work, and in the last week of graduate school before they graduated, 5 members of my master's class were furiously working to do their theses on the Palmer sweat test. And then when I went to teach in New York City, I had a senior seminar where I had a student who could not put a verb and a noun correctly in a sentence, and I went to the dean and said, I will not pass this student unless she can learn to write. And I had a lot of heat over that one. And so, you know, The question I have to ask is, with the new technology, are we dumbing down because we have no litmus tests?
What do you mean by litmus test?
Well, I'm sorry, we lost the caller already. I apologize. So maybe just answer the question without the litmus
test
clause. Right, right.
Try, you know, that the technology is dumbing the population down, I think, is beyond debate. And I don't think we have come to terms yet with the damage, the intellectual damage that television in particular has done to the American population. So I think some future historians may choose to assess that.
If they're smart enough to figure it out.
Yeah, right. Good point.
Let's go back to the phone lines, if we can. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on with Morris Berman.
Well, it wouldn't be the intrinsic technology. It's the corporate use and the dumbing of the messages that are dumbing. I don't think one should reduce it by blaming the technology. I have a similar point to the point about, it seems by identifying with the American empire and saying the Dark Ages are involved because it's declining, I think that's just a distressing thing for me. It seems to me that maybe it's quixotic, but the best thing that we can do is work towards dismantling American empire from the inside and trying to authentically promote democracy here and hopefully abroad as well, as opposed to this imperial edict. But the idea that Dark Ages is an inevitable part of a decline of an empire, I think, I don't buy that as history. Taking the Roman or the American foot off of the back of the slave is a good thing intrinsically, it seems to me.
Morris?
Well, yeah, I would agree with you, but there is no case I know of historically of an empire or a civilization that was on a downward slide that was able to reverse that slide. And the pattern is to go into a period.
I mean, your argument is, to follow up on his point, is that there is not enough of an internal body of people in the United States who are opposed to the trends in this country who are going to organize to stand up to change the structures of the country.
That was the second point I was going to make. There are no, there's no levers of power of change. You can't point to them. Certainly it's not the Democratic Party. That would be a joke. So you can't point to the levers of power that are going to turn things around. I don't see them. I mean, I'd be delighted to see them, but I don't see them.
Okay, on that note, let's get back to our final caller. Line 3, Champaign, thank you for your patience. Please, you're on the air with Morris Berman.
Hi. Rome, even under the Republic, was not a democracy in the sense that it could not replace the government as we can. That makes our situation quite different from Rome if we use the power that we have. I'd like you to address that. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, Rome was not a democracy. It was a republic. It was not a democracy. Athens, one could argue, was different, was a democracy. But the whole issue of addressing things at the polls for change, I really don't rule it out in certain cases. I think, for example, that's what's happened with Latin America after, you know, decades of bloody revolution that didn't really, were just revolving doors. Those folks went to the polls and they elected people like Lula in Brazil and Chavez in Venezuela and Kirchner in Argentina and so on that are taking anti-neoliberal economic views. And in that sense, the electoral process is moving those countries.
Well, on the most cheerful note of the show, I think we're going to end today, Morris Berman. I hear the band tuning up in the background, and that means Travis Smiley is going to push us out of the studio here at WIL AM 580. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank my producer, Andrew Boyle, our technical director, Brett Polson, and we'll be back in 167 hours with another Media Matters. And again, thank you very much, Morris Berman, for joining us today.